The sixth talk in the series, The Crisis of Faith Today, Will He Find Faith on the Earth?, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 4, 2016, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Paper number 2, History of False Alternatives to Authentic Belief in Jesus, accompanies this talk.
I'm going to try to finish this series next week. So in order to do that, I may resort to reading some paragraphs here to help me be a little bit more brief and succinct. We're in the part of the series where I'm going through the history of the faith and looking at six important challenges, alternatives that God offered throughout history that were challenges to the apostolic truth, the apostolic gospel. We looked at the challenge of the Judaizers, then the challenge of Christianity itself, the Christian religion that got institutionalized. We looked at Gnosticism, and then we looked at theological liberalism. We're at the fifth one now, which is the social gospel. The social gospel could be lumped in together with theological liberalism on the one hand, but on the other hand, given what I want to do in this series, it's important to look at it separately. And here I'd like to just read a few paragraphs about it from the paper that I wrote. The social gospel grew out of the soil of the political turmoil and milieu that grew out of the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, and the militaristic secular evangelism of Napoleon. At the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, socialism, Marxism, and political nihilism became very popular and influential throughout Western civilization. They all shared one thing in common. Mankind's most pressing problems would be solved through social-political transformation. Nothing was more important than the establishment of social justice in the here and now. If Jesus is the Savior that Christians say he is, then most certainly he will be a prophet of social justice through social-political transformation. There's no other way to be a real Savior. This cultural mindset is what gave birth to the social gospel. It was a complete refashioning of Jesus' gospel message. The gospel was understood to be Jesus' declaration of the power and purpose of God to bring about his kingdom on earth. And most importantly, it included a call to Jesus' disciples to enter into God's power and purpose in this regard by working to reform all of the social and economic institutions and work to make them just. While the social gospel did not typically deny the eternal salvation of the individual human being, it did tend to minimize it. Oh yes, Jesus came to save individual sinners from ultimate destruction, but let's not forget the really important stuff that Jesus came to do. The clear emphasis of the social gospel was its call to work diligently to fight institutionalized evil and to bring about social justice. And its overwhelming flavor tended to become political. The emphasis did not fall on fighting institutional evil by rescuing the victims of injustice one by one in individual acts of love. Rather, one must fight to destroy the evil institutions themselves. And to do that, one must use the political institutions and the power of politics. In time, the common ground between progressivism, the political ideology, and the social gospel increased. For some such Christians today, it is difficult to see much difference between their mindset and beliefs and those of a secular progressive. the primary legacy of the social gospel in terms of its import to this paper. The primary legacy of the social gospel is the eventual impact it had on evangelicalism. Within evangelicalism today is the deeply ingrained perspective that in order to be relevant, belief in Jesus must lead to and give support to the fight for social justice. Anything else would be a kind of pie-in-the-sky Christianity that lacks all relevance and plausibility. Now, what I'm building up to is the seventh alternative to Christianity, to biblical truth, and that is the postmodern Christianity. This social justice issue is going to be a big, huge, essential, central part of postmodern Christianity. So that's why I'm highlighting that here. I'll leave my critique for the time when I critique it in the context of postmodern Christianity. So I won't say anything more about that now. But this was at the turn of the last century, the turn into the 20th century, when all this stuff was coming into play, and it swept through many of the Christian institutions in this country, and it clearly left its mark on Christian culture. It basically resides in the mainstream Christian denominations, but it's also left its mark on evangelicalism, which prides itself in being more biblical than the mainstream denominations, but nonetheless, it left a huge mark there as well. So that's number five, and we'll talk about how that is at odds with biblical truth when we get there. Number six is the challenge of what I have called pagan Pentecostal spirituality. As I understand the 12th, 13th, and 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians, that's where you really find Paul interacting with this alternative. As I understand those chapters and the background to those chapters, what's happened in Corinth is that there's at least a faction within the church at Corinth that have thought about the Spirit of God that Jesus promised he was going to send into the world back in the upper room discourse in the Gospel of John. He said, I'm leaving and you can't come with me. Have no fear. I've prayed that the Father would send another Parakletos to you, the Spirit of truth whom the Father will send. Well, that Spirit that was promised, this faction in Corinth decided that you know that the Spirit is present and active by one or both of two things. One, the having an ecstatic experience created and induced by the Spirit of God, or being some kind of participant in a dramatic supernatural miracle that the Spirit produces. In one or both of those ways, you know that the Spirit of God is present if one of those two things happens. They were apparently claiming that these were happening. They were what they called speaking in tongues. In my judgment, what they were experiencing was the phenomenon of glossolalia, which does have a kind of ecstatic dimension to it. They were experiencing that on the one hand. On the other hand, they were claiming to be able to perform miracles and to prophesy, have supernatural knowledge and various other things. Very much like modern-day Pentecostalism in the 20th century, the charismatic movement down to the present day are making similar kinds of claims. In Corinth, Paul says, you have to understand, he begins that section, now concerning manifestations of the Spirit, it's literally, now concerning spiritual things, spiritual events, spiritual, and I think we would use the word manifestations here. Regarding manifestations of the Spirit, I don't want you to be unaware, brethren, he says. And then he goes on to basically describe how you actually ought to know that the Spirit of God is present and active in your life and in your midst. He says, no one can say Jesus is Lord except by the Spirit of God. The point that he's making is, how do you understand when the Spirit of God is active in your life, when God cuts through all of the rebellion, callousness, hardness of heart, resistance, rebellion against truth, and somehow flips that switch on your insides that makes you receptive, open, and willing to see the truth about Jesus. And then you lead, that results finally in you saying, Jesus is Lord. none of us would ever come to the point of being able and willing to confess Jesus as our Messiah and Lord if the Spirit of God had not invaded our lives and changed what needed to be changed to make that possible. That is the paramount manifestation of the work of the Spirit of God, the Spirit of truth. It's not ecstatic experience or dramatic supernatural miracles, he says. And then he likens it to the way they thought about spirituality when they were pagans. When you were a pagan and you went to a bacchanalia or you worshiped Dionysius, what did you expect? You were doing everything you could. You were drinking wine. You were dancing yourself into a frenzy. You were doing anything and everything you could to have an ecstatic experience that you interpreted as the God taking over your body, the God invading your body, taking over and giving you some kind of experience. That's how you thought as a pagan. And Paul's point is, that's not the way it works. Not with the Spirit of God. When he comes into the world and he invades the world, he doesn't typically do that. That's not what he's interested in doing, and that's not what you should be expecting. That's not what you should be looking for. Rather, you should be simply looking for a simple, straightforward declaration that Jesus is the Messiah that's coming from the heart, an authentic, genuine confession from the heart. If that happens, then the Spirit of God is at work because there's no other way it can happen. We are allergic to God and the things of God. We would never be able to get past our allergy and be willing to declare him the Messiah if the Spirit of God were not at work in us. Well, Paul, interestingly enough, in Corinth, in Corinthians, he doesn't accuse the faction in Corinth who is advocating this kind of pagan spirituality. He doesn't accuse them of proclaiming a different gospel. He did the Judaizers in the book of Galatians. He doesn't make the same charge toward this faction in Corinth. How are we to understand that? I think the reason is because it would be entirely possible to have a completely misplaced and faulty understanding of spirituality and yet understand the meaning and the significance of Jesus' death on the cross in exactly the right way, exactly the way Jesus and the apostles proclaimed it. You could understand the mercy of God that is available to you because of Jesus being your high priest and intercessor. You could understand all that and still have a really screwed up concept of spirituality as they did in Corinth. The Judaizers, Paul saw as actually a frontal attack against the meaning and significance of Jesus' death on the cross. And that's why he elevates it to the seriousness of, this is another gospel. This isn't even the gospel that the apostles proclaimed. That's not the case here. Why then is this not just one mistake among hundreds, scores of mistakes that Christians have made throughout human history? Why have I put it in the top six challenges to authentic belief? Even though it's not another gospel, I think it's a serious distraction from the truth, because somebody could be interested in knowing that God is present in the here and now, and God is active in the here and now in my life, who is totally uninterested in eternal life in the kingdom to come in the future, which is the actual real hope of the gospel. It's likely to be attractive to a different kind of person and to a different kind of heart. So we started this series talking about a teacher building on the foundation of Jesus Christ with hay, wood, and straw rather than gold, silver, and precious stones. What kind of person are you attracting when your message is come to Jesus and receive the Spirit and, wow, look at all the things that are going to happen in your life. Look at the ecstatic experiences you're going to have. Look at how it's going to make you feel close to God. You're going to see miracle after miracle after miracle. You will know beyond a shadow of a doubt that God is with you and that God loves you and that God knows you and that he's present with you. Well, who's going to be attracted to that kind of message? Well, not necessarily the authentic and true child of God. In a way, who wouldn't find that attractive if they thought it was at all real, if they thought it was at all authentic, who wouldn't be attracted to that? You don't have to be a child of God to be attracted to that. But the child of God is able to place his or her hope in something that to most people in the world seems incredibly remote and incredibly abstract and incredibly irrelevant to my life. Namely, in the far distant future, when I'm dead and gone, I'm going to be raised back to life and I'm going to be given existence and being in the eternal age, in the eternal kingdom of God to come. Most of us shut that future out. We don't even consider it relevant to us. And so if that's the hope of the gospel, then yeah, okay, great. It's wonderful that you Christians believe that, but I want something that's meaningful now. I want something to change my life now. I once had a conversation with someone very close to me who we were talking about the substance, the nature of the faith and what it offers, what the benefit of the faith is. And I was trying to make the case that the benefit or the reward that comes to people who have faith is life after death, so conquering death and conquering sin. And I think, as I recall the conversation, the emphasis was the fact that I'm evil, I'm selfish, I'm a twisted version of a human being right now that doesn't really deserve to go on existing. But what if I could be remade into a truly good and morally beautiful creature? Wouldn't that be wonderful? Wouldn't that be good news? And I was pouring my heart out about how wonderful that would be, and they responded, well, if that's all Jesus does, then I'm not interested. It took me aback. Now, knowing the person, I don't think they meant it. I think that was a rhetorical move on their part. I don't think they really meant it. I think they were truer believers than that. I think they were more authentic than that. But it was a wonderful example to me. It gave expression to exactly what the heart of unbelief does believe and does respond to. Oh, is that all? Eternal life where you're morally perfect forever and ever? Ah, that's no big deal. I'm not interested. Because we have the ability to make that, it's so universal. Well, of course, everybody gets that. After you die, that's where you go. That's what happens. That's where you, at least if you're a Christian, that's what you have. Everybody gets that. So it ceases to be interesting because it's so universal, right? Well, we don't get it if we can make that move where we just push it off into an abstraction in the future that ceases to be interesting to us. Who does that remain interesting to? The authentic child of God who's being invited and called by God to belong to him. In fact, I would argue the longer we live, the more we mature, the more we grow, the more interesting that becomes, and absolutely exciting that that becomes. Well, pagan Pentecostal spirituality, it is it working at cross purposes to that? Because it keeps insisting, no, what it's really all about is knowing the power of God in your life right now. And if you're not feeling it, then what good is it? So you got to be feeling it and feeling it now. So I think it's a huge, huge distraction. And that's why I include it here as a very important obstacle to genuine faith. Evangelicalism, which I still to this day feel most affinity with, it's my background, it's what I grew up in, it's what I know. I know that evangelicalism would not claim me as their own any longer, but it's nevertheless what I feel most affinity with. What about evangelicalism? Evangelicalism's self-concept is as an heir of the true apostolic faith. As an evangelical, I thought of myself as being a part of a tradition that had seen through all the ways that other Christians through history had gone astray and had got it wrong. And they had gone off on this path and this path and the other path and the other path, and they had strayed from the straight and narrow path of the apostolic truth. But evangelicals, because they are so grounded in the Bible, have remained true to that. The historical roots of evangelicalism, you probably know, they came out of fundamentalism at the turn of the century, the 20th century. The fundamentalists were a group of academics, Christian intellectuals, who saw coming into the universities and the seminaries and the churches and all the institutions of Christian culture, the theological liberalism that we talked about last week became more and more entrenched and actually took over the universities. How did that happen? Well, they had the cultural momentum, and that's going to become important to my talk next week. Theological liberalism was swimming downstream. Anyone who wanted to believe in the truth of the apostolic gospel has to swim upstream. Theological liberalism had an incredible advantage. The same is true today. Postmodern Christianity is swimming with the current. Anyone who wants to hold on to the apostolic truth taught by Jesus and the apostles has to swim against the current. So postmodern Christianity in the future, in the days to come, has all the advantage in terms of being able to win out in the hearts and minds of the vast majority of people in the culture. Well, at the turn of the last century, that's what was happening in the modernist fundamentalist debate, the theological liberal fundamentalist debate. The modernist, the theological liberal, had all the momentum. Culture was with him. It was easy for them to win the hearts and minds, take over the seminaries, take over the churches, take over the universities. And the fundamentalists became more and more pushed out, shoved out, defeated. So what did they do? They formed their own little subculture. And what historians describe it as, they developed what they called a fortress mentality, where they had their own little church retreats and denominations and camps and schools and universities and seminaries that they built for themselves. And they had this kind of parallel network to go along mainstream American Christianity, because they were kicked out of mainstream American Christianity, so they had to form their own little subculture. The younger fundamentalists coming along did not like the fact that the fundamentalists were not exactly culturally engaged. They were living off here by themselves. They weren't going into the university and going into the media, into the entertainment industry, into politics, into business, and so on, and trying to redeem culture for Christ by actually entering in and engaging the culture. So those younger fundamentalists started a movement that came to be known as evangelical Christianity. Theologically, they claimed to be exactly in the same place the fundamentalists were. They believed all the same things the fundamentalists did, but unlike the fundamentalists, they did not believe that you should run away from culture. They believed that you should run toward culture and become culturally engaged. That's what made evangelicalism evangelicalism. For most of my life, I have been very sympathetic with the evangelicals, the founders of evangelicalism. Yeah, we should be culturally engaged. In recent times, I've become more understanding of the fundamentalists. The fundamentalists did not leave culture. They got shoved out of culture. That's becoming more and more clear to me. It wasn't their choice to not be culturally engaged. It was sort of forced upon them. What happened when those evangelicals became culturally engaged? Well, in my youth, I thought, well, yeah, we should become fully participating members of American culture and change it and transform it and win it for Jesus and so on and so forth, all that. Well, as I've watched over the past 3 decades, what happened? Did American culture get won for Jesus? I don't think so. What I saw instead is evangelicalism starting off like fundamentalists in their commitment to biblical authority, in their commitment to biblical inerrancy, in their commitment to the truth that the Bible taught. What's happened? Bit by bit, all those commitments have eroded. And evangelicalism is pathetically out of touch with biblical Christianity today in so many different ways. I should have brought it, but Jody just showed me something that she saw on the internet about a guy who went to an evangelical megachurch in Florida and describing his experience there. Nobody had a Bible. A Bible verse from the book of James was mentioned, but it just became a springboard for diversity, inclusion, anything that you would hear from in the media, in the mainstream media today. Same kind of ethic, the same kind of virtues, the same kind of message. That's not taking the Bible seriously. Something else is going on there. In fact, I would argue that that church looks like an exhibit A of postmodern Christianity to me. So in terms of these obstacles to authentic belief, what has evangelicalism become? It's actually become a repository to five of the six obstacles to belief. You find factions, streams, currents within evangelicalism that are reviving the Judaistic fallacy, the Judaistic challenge. You find a current within evangelicalism that has adopted liberalism and its skeptical attitude toward the accuracy and authority of the Bible, and they really have a very, very soft view of biblical authority. You find another current within evangelicalism that sees social justice as the central call of the Bible. It's absolutely essential and central to the message of the Bible. And then you clearly still have a stream within evangelicalism that sees ecstatic experience and or miracles as the apex of spirituality. All of that is alive and well in this rather big tent that we call evangelicalism. So evangelicalism is not just one obstacle, it's a boatload of obstacles, ways of being distracted, ways of going wrong, ways of not really understanding the apostolic truth. So I don't put it as one of the six because it basically is just the summation of all the others. So today, and I will introduce it today and then we'll really get into a critique and analysis of it next week. The new peril that I see is what I have called postmodern Christianity. What do I mean by that? Postmodern Christianity, as I'm defining it, is the Christian version of what I will call postmodern secular progressivist religion, which I will affectionately describe as PSP religion, just for short. Now, I hope that's not confusing. It's just such a mouthful. I'd like to shorten it if I can. So PSP religion, postmodern secular progressivism. I would argue that the religion of postmodern secular progressivism is the civil religion of America. Now, I need to define both of those things. What do I mean by religion? And then what do I mean by civil religion? The concept of religion that I'm using is if we have a set of beliefs, values, and practices where I can qualify as a good, enlightened, and righteous individual by believing those beliefs, holding those values, and practicing those practices. If someone hands me that set of beliefs, values, and practices, and I do them, and that gives me the ground and the basis for me being able to look at myself and say, oh, what a good boy am I. I am righteous. I am pleasing. I am what a human being ought to be. That's religion. Belief in God, by my definition, is not even necessary. You can be an atheist and be religious by this definition. Some atheists I've met are the most religious people I know in this sense. What we're going to find is, if you go back to Phariseeism, what kind of righteousness did you earn? It was the righteousness of obedience. In postmodern secular progressivism, it's the righteousness of enlightenment. You are righteous because you are enlightened, because you're one of the hip people. You're one of the people who really sees, who really gets it. You're one of those good people who really values what really ought to be valued and places important what really ought to be placed as important. So you're one of the good guys. And it's that kind of righteousness that you earn in postmodern secular progressivism. Back when God was in the picture, it was righteousness through obedience of one kind or another. Well, that's off the table if you're an atheist. You're not obeying anybody or anything, but you sure as hell are more enlightened than all those other, like, theists out there. You know so much more, you're smarter, you're more rational, you have more intellectual integrity. There's all these virtues that you possess as proved by your atheism or your secularism or your scientism or something related to that. So the way I'm using the word religion doesn't even demand, require that you believe in God. The way I'm using the word religion, it's never a good thing. Religion is always inimical to belief in the apostolic truth, belief in the truth that is proclaimed in the Bible. It has to be, because the truth that's proclaimed in the Bible begins with the premise that we are all unrighteous. We are unworthy. We are undeserving. What we deserve is destruction, condemnation. I'm not a good person. I'm an evil person. I'm broken. I'm a poor excuse for a human being. I'm not what I really ought to be. That's where it starts. And then there is the good news of, but God's not going to hold it against you. You may not deserve any blessing from God, but he's going to give it to you. He's going to give you the blessing that you don't deserve. That's the truth. Religion can only interfere with me believing, understanding, and embracing that truth. Because religion, by its very nature, as I'm defining it, by its very nature, is the strategy whereby I can find a basis of reframing my whole existence. I'm not a bad person. I'm a good person. I'm not an unworthy person. I'm a worthy person. And how do I know that? Well, look, here's what I do. Here's what I believe. Here's what I value. That's what good people do believe and value. So I'm a good person. That's true whether you're a Pharisee in the time of Jesus, or it's true whether you're a postmodern secular progressivist today. Religion is playing exactly the same role and has done so throughout all of human history. So notice that by its very nature, religion always creates self-righteousness, a kind of self-righteousness, with all the obnoxiousness that comes with that. So again, you don't have to be a fundamentalist or a Pharisee or Christian religious nut to be self-righteous. Atheists and secular progressives are some of the most self-righteous people you'll ever see, for exactly the same reason, because they're religious. They have adopted the strategy of religion to deal with their relationship with God and their deep-seated understanding that they really are unworthy. How are they going to cope with it? By reframing it. No, I'm not unworthy. Here's why I'm worthy. And that leads to the kind of self-righteousness that you see manifest in the life of every religious person's life, no matter what religion it is and no matter what form of religion it takes. The other thing that's critical to understand when I call it a religion is that notice that the role of religion then is not to put me in contact with truth. Truth has nothing to do with religion. It's not about truth. It's about me feeling righteous, about me thinking that I can view myself as righteous. And truth has nothing to do with that. It doesn't really matter what the truth is. It doesn't matter whether the beliefs that I believe are true or not true. It doesn't really make any difference. Why? Because they work to allow me to think of myself as righteous, and that's their role. That's why I believe them. I don't believe them because I think they're true. That's why it's impossible, absolutely impossible, to argue with a religious person. Here are the facts. Here's the evidence. Let me give you this argument. Here's why I think you're wrong. Yes, but I have faith. Yeah, you may think I'm wrong, but I have faith. That is to say, I believe it anyway, even though you've given me all the facts and the evidence and the arguments in the world that should persuade me that it's not true. But what's truth have to do with it? I don't believe it because I think it's true. I believe it because it's part of my religion. And we've literally invented a category for that. We call it faith. Not what the Bible means by faith. It's a ripping off, it's an appropriating that word and giving it a radically different definition. So we have taken faith to mean something I'm justified in believing, even though I know perfectly well that it ain't true, because truth has nothing to do with it. That's what we really mean. So you can't argue a religious person out of their religious beliefs. You can't. Okay, what do I mean by civil religion then? By calling it a civil religion, I'm saying that it's the religious perspective that's taught, proclaimed, propagated, and enforced in all the major institutions of modern American culture. The universities, the public schools, most of the private schools, the media in all of its various forms, the bureaucracy of our government, therefore the state, you name it, the courts, you name it, this is the religion, what I'm calling postmodern secular progressivism, that's the religion that is propagated and enforced in every one of these institutions. So, to understand postmodern Christianity, now, so I've been talking about PSP, postmodern secular progressivism. You don't have to be a Christian to believe in postmodern secular progressivism. But when a Christian takes the civil religion of PSP and creates a syncretism between the civil religion of PSP and their Christianity and rolls it into a new version of Christianity, that's what I'm calling postmodern Christianity. So to understand postmodern Christianity, we have to understand better the civil religion of PSP. Well, it may surprise you that PSP is secular, progressive, and postmodern. So let's take those one at a time. Secular, there's no God. There's only matter and energy. Materialism is the worldview. Everything is made of stuff. God didn't create man. Man created God. God is just an idea that man came up with along the line. Even if incoherently an adherent to PSP does believe in a God, his God is a kind of an irrelevant add-on to a worldview that's entirely materialistic. As a matter of habit, momentum in the person's life, they may say they believe in a God, but it's a God who's utterly irrelevant to them, just kind of stuck on and added on to what otherwise is a worldview that doesn't need a God at all. So it's secular. It's also progressive. And for that, let me read some out of my paper. To say that the postmodern secular progressive religion is progressive is to say that PSP religion embraces the values, goals, emphases, and perceptions of progressivism. By progressivism, I mean the social-political belief system arising out of the Enlightenment, ultimately, that has the following characteristics. One, a secular belief that every evil and injustice, every obstacle to human flourishing, and every source of suffering arises from evil elements that are built into the very fabric of society. Therefore, the only way to promote human flourishing is to transform society. Only by creating a truly good and just society can one promote human flourishing. Two, a fully secular belief that the greatest good that any individual can achieve, the greatest good any individual can hope for, is to live in a truly good and just society during the course of his physical existence. Correspondingly, the best thing I can accomplish in the world is to serve to promote a better and more just society during my lifetime. Three, a general belief that because humanity has left its superstitious religious past behind, humanity has entered upon a path toward what is true and right. Mankind's understanding, therefore, can be expected to grow ever truer and better as time marches on. Therefore, all change in cultural beliefs, values, and attitudes will be a change for the better. The more we learn, the better we understand. Furthermore, the more we learn and the better we understand, the less inclined we will be to believe in God and the transcendent. Four, a corresponding belief that experts and professionals, those who have a real mastery of the truer and better knowledge at which mankind has arrived, they are those who know best how each and every individual ought to conduct his life. And five, a more specific belief that the governance of any given society ought to be placed in the hands of those experts and professionals. The common man cannot be trusted to act in such a way that he will act in his own true best interest. Certainly, he cannot be trusted to act in such a way that he will act in the society's best interest. Belief in the existence of a cultural elite is endemic to progressivist social theory. There's a class of people who are smart enough, moral enough, and enlightened enough that they are competent to engineer a truly good and just society. the new elite class envisioned by progressivism is not defined by birth or wealth, and therefore it is not a fixed class. It is defined by being enlightened enough to be in the inner circle of those who know how to promote a better and more just society. Someone can become a member of this elite inner circle simply by becoming sufficiently enlightened. In older, more traditional times, there were always people who would imitate the style, dress, manners, speech, and so forth of the nobility because they desired that other people perceive them as belonging to the elite inner circle of the nobility. Similarly, progressivism creates a new inner circle to which many aspire to belong. By adopting the fashionable beliefs, values, and attitudes of the elite class, one can believe of himself that others perceive him as belonging to that inner circle of the enlightened. In other words, one need not actually have position, power, and influence to belong to the elite enlightened class of the progressivist imagination. One need only conform his values and beliefs to the standards of progressivist orthodoxy. And then finally, this religion is also postmodern. Because it's postmodern, it embraces the analysis of truth and rationality that are advanced in postmodernism. So what is that? To the postmodernist, what an individual, or more accurately, a community, say a community like ours, what we take to be true, what we claim to be true, is not something that is in contact with objective reality, such that what we believe is describing the way things actually are. That's not what actually is going on. What's going on is we have our own distinctive take on reality. Here's what we believe. Here's what we think. Here's how we see it. Here's how we put things together in our understanding of the world. That's our take on reality. The most any human being and the most any community can ever attain to is to have their own distinctive take on reality. No one, nowhere, nohow has actually made contact with the way things really are. That's a dogma of postmodernism. In fact, to make that claim is evil. You're dogmatic and arrogant in an evil sort of way. So what we call truth is simply my take on reality. So to say something is true, if I say it's true that Jesus is the Messiah, what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is there ain't nobody out there who's going to object. Richard Rorty, the Princeton pragmatist philosopher at one point said, truth is what my colleagues will let me get away with. That was his definition of truth. Classic, typical, postmodern kind of definition of truth. So if you let me get away with saying Jesus is the Messiah, then at least within our community, that's the truth. And that's what I mean by calling it the truth. But we're being naive and silly and ridiculous if we think I'm actually describing something about the way reality actually is when I make that claim. That would be arrogant to be saying that. The other aspect of postmodernism is truth then, within a larger society, is what allows the dominant class to maintain their status and their dominance and control. Because if what we say is true gets imposed on everyone else in the society, then we get to whistle the tune that everyone else dances to. So we maintain our place of importance, our status, our control, our governance, our dominance by saying, this is the truth. That is, this is what you need to let me get away with saying. The other aspect of postmodernism is that language then governs thought and perception. What we say about reality ends up being what we think about reality and what we see is the case. So I'm sure you've heard a lot in the cultural debate today about political correctness and the policing of speech. Where is that coming from? Well, it's coming out of the theory of postmodernism that says, if I can control the way you speak, I'm going to ultimately be controlling the way you think and the way you perceive. So I don't dare let you call homosexuality sin, because then you're going to think about it in a different way than if you don't call it sin. So I'm not even going to let you say it. In fact, in Canada, people have been brought up on charges from the pulpit teaching out of Romans 1 saying that homosexuality is sin. Where is that coming from? From their theory that we have to control the way people use their language because we want to change society. We want to change its values, and the only way to change its values is to control what they say and how they say it. Okay, a little bit more. So the PSP religion, civil religion, has all the advantages in the culture today. That's the current is running that direction. There's just no question about it. So Christians who are trying to come to terms with their culture, it's perfectly understandable that they adopt many of the tenets, the beliefs, the values, and the practices of PSP religion, civil religion. Of course they will. It takes an incredible amount of courage, and mostly courage, to stand against it and just refuse to be swayed by it just because that's the way the current is going. I would analyze America today by suggesting that it's divided between two major religions. Now, there are other minor religions, obviously, but there's two major religions. There's the PSP civil religion, and then there's the Christian religion. Now, we, if you agree with me, we don't really belong to either. If we are truly authentic disciples of Jesus, we're going an entirely different way. We're not committed to a religion at all. We're not religious people. So that's not what we're doing. But there are people who have believed in the Christian religion. That is a major force within American culture still to this day. But then the other one is the PSP civil religion. It seems to me that we are in an equipoise between those two religions in America today. And this last presidential election, I would analyze it in terms of we saw the conflict between these two religions at play. Trump got the vote of the Christian religion, and Hillary was, of course, the patron saint of the PSP religion. And they came into serious, significant conflict with each other. Now, when I say Trump got the vote of the Christian religion, it's fascinating to me that you had as many evangelicals willing to vote for Trump and line up and publicly and support Trump. Trump is the least likely person for an evangelical to support in the entire universe. He is an immoral man. He wouldn't know sexual purity if it spit in his face from just the public record, from just what he himself would admit. There are just all kinds of reasons why he's so unlikely. But he captured the imagination of people in the Christian religion who said, I think, in spite of the fact that he is not a godly man, he is not a righteous man. That doesn't even seem to be being offered up to us as a choice. In spite of the fact that he's not a godly man who even understands faith and understands evangelicals, I think he will be our champion. And I think he's willing to give us the right to practice our Christian religion unmolested, unlike anything else. The difference between the Christian religion and the PSP religion, the Christian religion, ironically, has the resources to make room for the PSP religion. The PSP religion has no resources within it to make room for the Christian religion. It has to destroy it. And evangelicals have felt that. If they haven't been able to articulate it, they've at least felt it, and they've had an intuition about that. And along comes a man who, it looks to them, is willing to defend them against the destructive intentions and purposes of the PSP religion that will not tolerate the Christian religion. Now remember, we should be on the sidelines to this whole thing. This is not about us. We're doing a whole different thing. But obviously, in terms of worldview, we have a whole lot more in common with the Christian religion than we do with the PSP religion. We have virtually nothing in common with the PSP religion. And the PSP religion is not going to allow me to object. I'm not really religious. I'm not really a Christian. Yeah. Yeah, you're not anymore. They're not going to make any distinction. because I'm going to look like a Christian to them as a follower of Jesus. So just a very, very interesting collision between these two religions. That was a skirmish in what is a religious war in America. It's been called a culture war for decades, but it's become clearer and clearer to me that what has been called a culture war is not a culture war. It's a religious war, worthy of Northern Ireland. No weapons yet. Not a hot war. It's a cold war. But it's a cold war between two incompatible religions. In the long term, I don't see any solution except civil war. They can't coexist. They can't be reconciled just by the very nature of what they are, unless I'm terribly mistaken about that. Okay, let me stop there. I'm sorry, I haven't left a lot of time.
Thanks, Jack. That was really helpful. A couple clarification questions. Mm-hmm. So you talked about language being controlled. Mm-hmm. That's an element of postmodernism. Mm-hmm. So, like, are you thinking in terms of hate speech, let's say? Like, that be something that's a way that our language... Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Hate speech as postmodernist and as the PSP religion defines that. Because me getting up and reading Romans 1 would, for a significant number of people in the culture today, I would be accused of engaging in hate speech just by virtue of the fact that I read Paul's words there. So, yeah, exactly. Now, we do have to make a distinction. There's a difference between actually being a jerk and saying things that are offensive by their very nature conceptually. It's not hate speech to use the concept of sin in a discussion of the things that a Christian believes are sin. Am I saying that I think you're wrong to practice it? Yeah, by implication, I am saying that. That may be offensive, but it doesn't necessarily make me a jerk. It doesn't mean I'm mean. It doesn't mean I'm unkind. It doesn't mean I'm unloving. I'm just speaking the truth as I see it. But within the context of postmodernism, that distinction is completely lost and completely obliterated. Hate speech is not being hateful in what you say. Hate speech is using the kind of language that marginalizes a group, period. And that's, by definition, hate speech to them.
Okay, and then just so I understand, like from a philosophical perspective, is progressivism just the next step of postmodernism? Or is it...
Postmodernism is newer than progressivism. Progressivism started really, arguably, all the way back in the Enlightenment. The French Revolution the name wasn't in use at the time, but I would argue that the French Revolution was conducted by progressives. They're really nihilists. They wanted to wipe the slate clean, start all over, and build a utopian society, a just society, a righteous society, and so on, having wiped the slate clean. But it goes all the way back to the Enlightenment, where people got the idea that out of the Middle Ages, with all of its superstition and religious belief and so on, the Enlightenment thinkers began to think, now that we've discovered science and we've rejected the authority of the Bible and the authority of the church and the authority of religion and have realized how much that led us astray, now let us grow in our knowledge and our understanding that science is going to bring and rationality is going to bring, and look at what we'll do now. We'll make the world more civilized, more decent. We'll do away with poverty and disease and war and all these evils. We're going to do away with all that stuff. That's the progressivist impulse. The other part of the Enlightenment was it was very optimistic for the same reason. The future is just going to get better and better and better and better, and that's another impulse within progressivism. We're always the enlightened vanguard on the cutting edge of better, the progressivism.
So it's been used in like philosophical understanding for a long time, the concept of progressivism.
Right.
But then maybe now in our day and age, that term is being used again, like within this cultural, like by the PCP civil.
Yeah.
Like they're really adopting that term.
Yeah, was in vogue in the early part of the 20th century. Teddy Roosevelt was a progressivist. FDR was a progressivist. Wilson was a progressivist. So there was a lot of presidents we had who fancied themselves progressives.
So the Democratic Party has really adopted that in many ways, that ideology of progressivism.
Well, as I say, the ideology has never really died, but the label is being appropriated once again. It had moved from progressive to liberal. And now, for whatever reason, I don't really understand, liberal went out of vogue and became a bad name. So they began to call it progressive again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Postmodernism is newer. Postmodernism is a 20th century concoction. And arguably, never in history have the ideas and the view of truth and rationality that you find central to postmodernism never had that had any kind of traction, any kind of acceptance throughout all of human history until the middle of the 20th century.
Where do I begin? Feel as if you're a bit uncharitable to the French Revolution. Granted, no one here is too offended because, you know, nobody here participated in that fine event. We have had conversations about this, and me being self-proclaimed postmodern Christian era, our perspective is, I think the touch point was where you basically described that there are two religions in America, but you seem to pick the wrong one at that point.
Okay.
So the tradition that I experienced being an American in 21st, 22nd century is one that when we get close enough to the higher ideals of the French Revolution, which are that the government should be for the people, that it should be organized, the egalitarian elements of the French Revolution, the democratic elements of the French Revolution, those features that I think the founding fathers brought into America. When we see those tools and those devices played out within our government, within our organizational structures of society, I'm inclined to be on the side of the PSP religion, given that I see a unity with what I believe is the bright idea of the French Revolution.
Okay, but before you go on,
yes,
those are not incompatible with the Christian religion.
But they are incompatible with conservatives.
They're not.
Yeah. So, and here's where we...
They may not be practiced by conservatives.
Well, my experience of the culture war, and I think it was really pivotal because you said PSPs cannot make room for the evangelicals, but the evangelicals can make room for the PSPs. There is the greatest I don't understand. That is.
Okay, well, listen to my words carefully.
I'm going to.
It has the resources to make room for them. I'm not saying they necessarily do or will or have, or I will grant you there have been all kinds... I have not been treated well by evangelicals
you
myself.
Have not, you know? Which is always
okay.
Amazing to me.
So I understand that it has all the potential for being...
Yeah. I'm going to see you next week, probably.
Okay.
But I just want you to be aware that coming from the other side of the what you called the culture war, it's very difficult to see the conservative wing as the one that are in defense of the democratic notions of how government should be run. Their call to authority, their paradigm is justified off things that are, and I think you would identify, are fundamentalist in the way that you use the word. And that feels inconsistent with the nature of American democracy, if that okay. doesn't blow your head off your body.
Okay. So there you go. Okay. Well, see you next week. And I've kept you a little bit over.